Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. One of the Magnificent Seven, Apple, took a massive hit. Ross tells us why. Takes a look at gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He also has a special offer for our listeners. President of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated, Danielle Park, wades into interest rates and why Canada's economy is especially vulnerable to higher mortgage rates. Tim Cycles Van Wood joins us to explain why he believes supply chain issues, not money supply, are driving inflation and that hiking interest rates just makes it worse. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Miselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at @chartsbyRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, do we have a special offer for our listeners this week?
Yes, we're continuing on with the 25% off for the new annual subscriptions. And, you know, we're at that point of the year where opportunities really do tend to arise. The seasonality where you have the choppy summer and then invariably will test your support levels in September, October. And, in 80% of the years, it does manage to eke out a pretty good correction. 20% of the years, the market just walks its way back up. So what we want to be looking for is opportunities where we see good oversold conditions in stocks that have been beaten down, and we're going to look for other stocks which have reasonable buoyancy and where the sectors are really showing some pretty good life. And as I say, probably over the next 6 weeks or so, I think we should be looking at some pretty good opportunities.
So how would you sum up what happened on the stock markets this past week?
Well, this week we finished off going into the long weekend with a nice little run a week ago Friday, and got into some, pretty good overbought positions. Markets have bounced off the 20-week moving averages. That's the normal in a good, steady rising trend. And so the correction that we had seen through the summer into August, there was a good test of support and a nice little bounce, but got ahead of itself. And so this was the week to correct back. And, in the midst of all of this, China says that they're not too happy with Apple right now, and they're going to cut back on use of the products for the government workers. So, a pretty good hiccup there. Apple down about 6% on that news. A lot of money coming off the table as far as that's concerned, but on a relative basis, still well above the highs that it's been seeing for the last couple of years. So that trend is still up. Support levels are nicely underneath the market here that we've been looking at. Ideally, we wanted to see Apple hold around its moving averages, and if it doesn't hold in here, we've got some good price levels underneath, and we've seen some nice spikes down historically that have given us some good opportunities, and I hope we do see one of those in Apple in the next month or so.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar just continues to just slowly grind its way higher. With what are we up about 5% now since the lows that were put in during the summer, and probably getting, as said maybe a week ago, getting a little ahead of itself. This week was had another little pop, but not dramatic. And on the other side of the coin, the Canadian dollar down, and we are now to the point where you start to think about where the support levels will be. And you know, Bob's been thinking that clearly we're going to be down to numbers that start with a 6 instead of a 7, and I would think comes after a bit of a bounce, because the weekly charts on the Canadian are looking a little oversold right now. So any rally back to the 74, 74 and a quarter level is probably a saleable target up there.
Has the rising price of crude helped the Canadian dollar at all? It doesn't appear to be.
No. You know, you'd be expecting much better here. We just are not seeing it. And you've got decent agricultural prices. We take a look at the DBA, which is the agricultural index. That's had a pretty good run this year. It's gone from 19 and a quarter up to 22. So you've got a 10% move rise as far as general agricultural commodities are concerned. And, that should be doing far better to help the Canadian. And along with oil, which, you know, is now flirting is around this $80 level. This lack of strength in the Canada, you know, as soon as the commodities start to show a little bit of weakness, Canadian's going to get hit. We've got a graphic that we use for the historicals on that. So we'll, you look for potential divergences to find a bottom on the dollar, but they're just not in sight at this point.
What's going on with gold?
Gold got overbought a week ago and has sold off a bit. It's still, overall in just a trading range. And the modeling that we've got would show that you got a reasonable low in place at this point. Ideally, you want to be looking at the spot price pushing through the July high as the real catalyst point. Now, a week ago, we had a high in the 1955 level. We've been up to 1980-ish during July. That July high is very, very important here, because the cycle work that I've got and the models from previous consolidations would suggest that we're probably ready to break out within the next 4 or 5 weeks here. So we'll just be looking for some good buy signals into support. We're around 1915, 1920 on the spot price right now. And if it starts to get some life here, it could do reasonably well. And when you look at it, the strength that we've seen in the U.S. dollar index, we've not seen nearly the weakness that you would expect in gold. If gold had been doing on a relative basis, we'd be down probably at about 1860 or 1870 at this point. But it's managing to hold in reasonably well. The miners are not doing that well. If you take a look at the GDX, the GDXJ, on a relative basis to gold, hasn't done anything in 5 or 6 years here. And in the last few months, it's still the same model, just easing lower. And you'd want to see the GDX probably close through $30 on the upside would be a reasonable point to say that it had turned the corner and might see the beginning of a decent run there.
Ross, can you remind us again where we can find that special offer?
That's at chartsandmarkets.com and 25% off on new annual subscriptions.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
A pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Danielle Park next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, the Bank of Canada held interest rates this week at 5% with bias to tighten further as quantitative tightening continues. How is this likely to affect real estate and the economy?
Well, we have a highly levered economy, very much concentrated on levered activities, including things like real estate. And that's been the lion's share of our GDP growth. It's the lion's share of household debt is mortgages related to housing. About $2 trillion of it in Canada. And so that is definitely something that's vulnerable to the higher interest rate environment and the dramatically higher rate increases that we've seen in the last 18 months. So it does have a definite effect in terms of the overall economy. The thing is that there's a lead time there, and we've discussed this before. It's a lags of sort of 12 to 24 months before it sort of filters through. And so you tend to have, it's typical for people to underestimate this during a tightening cycle, to think, oh, look, we've increased rates by, you know, 475 basis points and everything seems to be fine. That's very common to say going into the lagged effects that usually hit by this, you know, after 12 months since the beginning of the hiking. And the fact that they paused is really just typical as well. After they've done that much, for them to wait and see what kind of impacts flow from there. We know that the overall economy is already slowing, and so we're watching that very carefully. Unemployment is already picking up. So I think that we're going to see more of that to come in the months ahead. And that's, you know, even if they don't hike any further, which the bond market seems to think they're done at this point, the bond market actually has been selling, the yields have been coming off now for several months, and that means government bonds have been rallying, which is a sort of a vote in favor of a slowing economy and the fact that they've hiked enough now to kill the inflationary impulse that they were concerned about.
Are U.S. mortgage rates leading Canadian mortgage rates higher?
Well, I wouldn't say that U.S. mortgage rates lead Canadian mortgage rates. I think it is much more a function of U.S. being the largest economy in the world, the largest consumption-based economy in the world, our largest trading partner, and a huge influence on global demand and financial conditions, primarily being the benchmark currency. And so what happens is that the U.S. Fed, you know, started leading. They typically lead monetary policy in the world. We've seen this now over the past many decades. They get concerned about either whether it's inflation, which has been the latest bogey, or typically when they are worried about a slowing economy, they tend to move back to tight or to cutting rates. And other central banks pay very close attention to them. Of course, the bulk of the world's debt is outstanding in U.S. dollars, so that makes a huge impact when central bank there is hiking interest rates, strengthening the U.S. dollar. That makes it more expensive for everybody else that owes money in U.S. dollars. And we've indeed seen the dollar index, which is the DXY, a basket of global currencies, has recently come back to 105, which is the highest since March of, at the beginning of the year, March of 2023, when the regional banking crisis was just starting in the United States. You saw, and this is very typical, you see financial strife break out, a flight to safety, you see government bond prices rise and the U.S. dollar rise relative to the other currencies. So the loonie has been very weak in this environment coming off for the past many months. And that is all sort of a reflection of this strong dollar and these higher rate differentials that are now in the United States. And even if the Bank of Canada remains on hold here, which I think is very likely because our economy is slowing quite fast, that you're probably, you may see the U.S. Fed hike one more time. I think they've done enough to blunt the concerns they had in the inflationary field. And we're starting to see such a drop in terms of consumption, in terms of investment, and all sorts of things. So I think, that the Bank of Canada, as I say, is likely to pause. The next bogey, of course, is when will they start cutting rates? And everyone is hoping that'll be soon. But I would say that you're more likely to see an extended pause this time unless you get a major banking blow-up or some major contraction in the stock market, which has been looking weak again in the last month. We'll see, you know, how much downside the leaders, the tech leaders, the Apples and Teslas have been coming off the boil again in the last little while. And they were really, you know, there was about 7 tech stocks that were holding up the stock market. But when you start to see some really serious downdraft on that side, you could see the Fed move back to, you know, trying to ease conditions again. But as you mentioned in your first question, both of these central banks are continuing to do quantitative tapering in this environment. So it's not just that they've hiked rates so much, they're continuing to roll off assets from the balance sheet, which is a further de facto monetary tightening. So it's really a massive impact that's going on throughout the economy. And as I said, like in Canada, we've already seen a nominal GDP growth is basically zero year over year, and the unemployment rate has already been increasing since last June. Residential construction peaked 9 quarters ago. So these are major economic sort of indicators, and the Bank of Canada was overly optimistic in terms of the growth that they were expecting to see in this, you know, this quarter and the next, and I think that the data is coming in on the downside. So it'll be very interesting to see how long central banks stay on hold in this environment. As I say, it'll be a function of how quickly things deteriorate. But it is also very common for them to say that they're pausing but not done yet. That's what they always say every cycle. They never do a last hike and say, there, we're done now, we're not going to do any more, because they're always worried at the peak of the cycle about, you know, inflation and trying to curtail runaway pricing and things. So it's very common for them to say, we're just pausing, but we're likely going to hike more. And I think in the next few months, we're going to see that they probably are done.
If incomes in Canada cannot support home prices with mortgage rates at these levels, what is stopping the housing market from crashing?
Well, it's back to the lagged effect stuff that I was speaking of. So we know, for example, that 85% of U.S. mortgages and 70% of Canadian mortgages were locked in when interest rates were below 3%. So that is something that, you know, it protects people from the immediate impacts of that major debt. So in other words, unless they've had a variable rate mortgage, of which there's been a significant proportion, but still overall, 70% of Canadian mortgages have been locked in. Now, the major difference is, of course, in the U.S., that means a 30-year fixed term, typically. In Canada, that means typically 1 to 5 year terms. So we know that about $1 trillion of our household debt is mortgages is coming up for renewal just in the next year alone, and that doesn't count the floating rate stuff. That's just the fixed term stuff. And so those people are facing, you know, if the average rate that they percent and they're facing something like 6%, that's going to be, and if they're trying to qualify for, you know, under the stress test, they have to qualify for more like 8% as a mortgage rate. And we know that basically the math is just horrendous. Like the average Canadian home price is about $754,000 nationally. That's down 10 or 11% from the all-time peak in February of 2022. But the minimum income you require to purchase or to borrow to buy or to borrow to refi a house like at that average level is $180,000 today, Jim. And I mean, 90% of Canadians don't make $180,000. Not 90% of households don't make $180,000. So they can't even qualify just for that. So you add to that the feature that we have had this bad decision, in my view, on the part of Canadian banks to extend and pretend. So as the rate hike cycle took fold, and we know that something like 40% of mortgages taken out in 20 to 21 in that range were variable floating rate because they were at such, at one point, at 1.65% or something was the all-time low in variable rates. So a lot of people were attracted to that as a way to reach or stretch to buy these insanely priced homes. So what happens is now, you know, we're starting to see the full impact of that, and the price is starting to fall. And we know that 70% of existing Canadian homeowners now have a mortgage. So all of this to say that there's a lot more pain coming up. There's very few people who can afford to refi their homes, which was a major form of funding in the last decade. People would ride the price of their home up, you know, refinance at very low rates, which were typically falling for much of that period, and then be able to take that money out and spend it in the consumption-based economy. That trend has gone away. We are no longer seeing that. And so it's not just the average price home, of course. In major cities like Vancouver and Toronto, as we've discussed before, average home prices are more than $1 million. So you've had this huge amount of build in the condo space because those were the relatively less expensive places. So we've got a lot of supply of the wrong kind of house today, and that is partly why you're seeing a sort of a slow bleed in terms of the impact of this. So it's not just that the lagged rates are taking time to filter through the economy. A lot of people are, as I say, not going to be able to refi or requalify, indeed, for a new fixed-term mortgage at current rates. And then the banks that were allowing people to extend and pretend by not making them make their full payments on these floating rate mortgages were adding this deficit or the amount they weren't paying to cover all the interest costs to the principal. So now you've got, not only has, you know, interest rates gone up, but a lot of people have actually grown the principal owing during this time as prices have come off nationally 11%. So it's really just a total nightmare. At the same time, you have the bank regulators sending out letters to, you know, telling the banks, send out letters and tell people they have to bring these mortgages back into conventional based, you know, if they're talking about refi, it has to be no more than 65% of the loan to value. If they're talking about the terms, then they have to work with you to add principal, lump sums, anything they can to bring that amortization back in line with historic norms, which was always 25 years at a maximum. But in the last, as I say, couple of years, the extend and pretend, we've now got some 25 to 40% of mortgages at the big banks, depending on the one, that have these amortizations greater than 25 years, which is like a forever mortgage. So all of this to say that the consumer is in a very rough spot, and that's starting to really show up in things like retail sales, And Toronto home sale prices, the markets have been generally frozen. Toronto home sales fell for their third consecutive month in August. But even at that, the average price of 1.16 is 10 times the average household income in that city. So, and the same, similar math in Vancouver. I know that, your prices there is about 1.2 is the average home price index. And it's just, likely to continue to weigh on the ability of people who's able to buy, and I think it's going to increase the amount of people looking to sell, because the reality is sort of a slow, it works through at a lag, but once it does, people are sort of realizing that they're way over their head, they have far too many costs, far too much housing expense, and some of these people, of course, have multiple properties. Many got the idea during the pandemic that it was a good thing to add a vacation home or maybe a Airbnb rental and this sort of thing, and they typically bought those things not only at peak prices but at floating rates. So I think that, you know, there's going to be an adjustment here in terms of the amount of properties coming up for sale. They tend to be, as I say, in the more expensive single-family home area, and that is probably the type that are the least amenable or able for people to buy. So we've got quite an imbalance. We've got all these new Canadians and students and immigrants looking for a place to live. They tend to need more like, you know, apartments and affordable housing units. We don't have enough of those, but we've got this massive supply of the most expensive real estate in the world, quite honestly. It is the most ludicrously valued real estate, with along with New Zealand, relative to incomes, relative to rents of anywhere in the world. So that is a major issue, and I think that price pressure will continue to build.
I don't know if you've answered this, but is housing inventory likely to remain low in the fall?
Well, I guess in the roundabout way of which I've just said is that there's reasons that inventory is bulky in certain spots at the moment. Like inventory, as I say, of starter homes is very low, and anything within any reasonable price range is almost impossible to find right now. But I think that, again, we've overbuilt the condo space, so there's a lot of those things that were bought on options, and they're coming to completion now. And as they come up for completion, people are sort of panicking. Some people who, put deposits down a couple of years ago are realizing that the math makes no sense or that they can't qualify for the financing. So you're starting to see more people listing and putting these properties on the market. And, in fact, the number of listings in the Toronto area rose for the fifth consecutive month in August as well. So I think that's going to be a trend that we will continue to see in the fall and beyond.
Danielle, anything else that you'd like to bring up in today's show?
I guess in terms of the corporate sector, it's interesting, too, because we've just talked about the household sector, but corporations did the same thing, of course, during the low rate environment. A lot of them borrowed money at very low levels of interest, but those are also typically fixed loans, either variable prime-based loans that have floated up extremely in the past year, but also a lot of fixed-term loans which are coming up for renewal. And indeed, we're seeing corporate bankruptcies in Canada are up 33% year-over-year and 25% in America. So I think the theme here is rising unemployment, because as companies go bankrupt, especially the smaller and medium-sized companies, which tend to be, supply the bulk of the job growth in the country. And a lot of the major or larger companies have had massive layoffs already. That's a theme, I think, where they're going to continue to look to cut their costs in this environment. And so that will spill over into the broader economy as well. And then you've got things like commercial property prices, which we didn't touch on, where they're off about 16% in price, so even more than the average home price and since March of 2022, and 31% in the office sector. What I think is really interesting, too, is when you line up all these parts that I'm talking about, all these asset types, whether it's the commercial space, whether it's households and home prices, whether it's the stock market, whether it's REITs, which are securities that are based on real estate sectors, whether it's commercial or office or all these different types, all of them typically have peaked in price sometime in the in early 2022 or late 2021, and many of them have been falling since then. So the good news here, first of all, it confirms this historical relationship of a high level of correlation between financial assets, because they all basically were impacted by the very lax credit years. And what you're starting to see is that correlation is working on the downside as well. And so things like, real estate investment trust, the REIT-based unit index that we typically will look to buy near cycle lows, it's come off already significantly from its high in October in about a year and a half ago. It's off about 23%. The preferred share index, again, something that people typically think of as more secure than common shares and higher yielding and tax preferred, it's come off about 27% since October of 21. So those are actually encouraging, because it shows that prices coming back down from the bubble highs. The yield, therefore, that you can earn as an investor goes up as price comes down. Now, the XRE yield or the REIT yield is still not sufficient. It's about 4.6%. And you think about relative to, short-term money, again, paying 5 and above right now, you've got less risk and more yield in the highest quality credit-based instruments. And there's not really much incentive to go buy some of this equity-based stuff that's come off, but probably has a lot further to go. Again, as I said, we're very early in the impacts of this whole tightening cycle in the economy. It's really just starting to show up now in the third quarter, and the fourth quarter is really where you're going to notice the bulk of this impact starting to be very evident. And that means that we could have a, you know, significant downdraft still in the equity market, the corporate debt market, the real estate market. And it's a function of, you know, there's going to be so much opportunity coming out of this that it'll be really hard to have enough capital to go around for the opportunities. But you prepare for that now with patience and discipline and having some liquidity and a sort of a buy list prepared and not sort of feeling the pressure to jump in too early.
Danielle, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Coming up, Tim Cyclesman Wood, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Tim Cyclesman Wood, editor of Cycles News and Views on cyclesman.com. He's speaking to us from Gulf Shores, Alabama. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Tim, can you tell us a little bit about your newsletter and how people can sign up for it?
Well, Jim, it is a statistical-based research letter, really. It's I feel like it's a little more than a newsletter. And I call it a research letter, but I combine cycles, quantitative analysis, and, you know, old school Dow theory, and, you know, I data mine, economic data and wrap, statistical, you know, quantifications around that data and, tie it to cycles. And so it's a statistical, it allows you to form a statistical based opinion based on, you know, all of that research, and, you know, form a roadmap as to where you are and where you're headed and how you think we get there. And it's available at cyclesman.com.
Tim, the Dow Jones Industrials saw a high on August 1st. The S&P and NASDAQ saw highs in July. What do you see ahead for those markets?
Well, looking at the cycles and in the absence of the proper cyclical setup in conjunction with those highs, I think we need to move higher. We had an intermediate degree low in August, and I think we need to move higher in order to see the proper cyclical structure and some of my so-called DNA markers, things that I look for to signal that you've seen a more significant top. And so, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule, but based on what I see here, if something should change, we should see alternative structure or something set up, then so be it. But looking at what I'm looking at here, I don't think this thing is quite done. We need to move higher. You know, it reminds me, kind of like 2007. You know, there was a top in the summer, and then we turned down, and I remember having phone calls and people saying, "Is it peaked? Is it peaked? Is this it?" I said, "No. We had some stuff missing to complete that top." And sure enough, we saw another push up into October, and it fell in place really quickly, and then it rolled. And so, in the absence of those things that we need to see to mark a top, you know, I'm leaning toward we need to go higher here before we have the opportunity to have a more meaningful peak.
If you say that we're going to go higher here, how does this fit in with your long-term views and the sixth economic cycle you've been writing about? And can you explain what the sixth economic cycle is and how it relates to us?
Sure, Jim. It's kind of deep, but again, we must have the proper cyclical structure in order to cap the advance out of the October 2022 four-year cycle low. Then, once the four-year cycle top is in place, it will be an opportunity to cap this long-term six economic cycle, which we should ideally see based on, you know, the environment we're in. Question will be, once the four-year cycle top is in and the six economic cycle, you know, begins to try to roll, can it be saved again? Again, based on where we are, I tend to think not, but we have to get that proper setup in place. And like I said, we're missing some things, in my opinion. This entire six economic cycle has been born out of the 2002 low. And the economic policies following that low have fueled this entire six economic cycle. And it's been the deflationary forces that began taking hold back at that 2002 low that the powers that be, the money masters, have been trying to fight all along. And so this six economic cycle, it being built or fueled, if you will, on those policies, it first tried to peak in 2007. And I remind you that that was the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And then it again tried to peak in 2020 with that four-year cycle top. And then, you know, of course, the next opportunity will be with this, you know, this next four-year cycle top, whenever that's in place, and we see, again, proper setup to cap that. It is that structural setup that I'm now monitoring very, very closely, you know, to see those, all the pieces, parts fall in place to have evidence that that top has occurred. Let me explain. You said explain the sixth economic cycle. Let's talk about these economic cycles themselves. Going back to 1800, I've identified six long-term economic cycles, and we're in the sixth now. The downturn of the last two, there's one in the 60s and then the one into 2000 top, you know, they were pretty mild, relatively speaking. And the reason for that is that we had a sound, particularly the one in the 60s, we had a sound economic underpinning. You know, the one in the 60s, it was followed by the great bear market, you know, into the 74 low, peaked in 66 and down to the 74. So, you know, there was an ugly downturn in the stock market, but we still had a strong underlying economy into that 2000 top. And again, the fifth cycle peaked in 2000, and this sixth cycle was born out of that 2002 low and the economic policies we've seen since then. But going back to the previous three of these long-term economic cycles and the downturns, they've been associated with the worst economic panics and crises in history. One example, following the First World War in 1921, there was a deflationary period, and it began then, and it kind of segued into, we saw the speculative period coming out of that that took us into the 29 top. But then both the 21 and the 29 panic, those were in association with the downturn out of that long-term six economic cycle. Like I said, one kind of segued into the other, and it was separated by that great mania into the 29 top. And then going back further in history, the same sort of thing. They're kind of a double hitters, if you will. It started in 1873, a deflationary crisis, panic crisis, as they called them back in the day. And that kind of segued into the 1893 crisis. And both of those, like I said, that was in association with the downturn of the second long-term economic cycle. And then the first, it peaked in 1819 and was followed by, again, kind of a doubleheader. It led to the panic and crisis of 1837. And the common denominator with these things is that they've all been accompanied by massive deflationary downturns, but they've all followed massively speculative, historic times. They've all also been associated with some shape or form of, a banking crisis. And we got a little taste of that. When was that? Earlier this year, late last year, when out of nowhere, we saw some banking issues. And I'm not sure that, based on this history, I think there's more of that to come. So, with that said, I want to add that another common denominator that I found, going back is into the 1860s, looking at my M2 data, I have found that each of these long-term cycles, downturns of each of these long-term cycles, has been associated with the M2 growth rate going below its zero line. There was one exception to this, and that one exception was in 1958. It turned below briefly, but all the dots didn't connect. That long-term economic cycle was still moving up, and so that was one exception. But with that one exception, and like I said, it's explainable, but with all the other cases, or in all the other cases, the downturn of the M2 growth rate below the zero line has been associated with these economic crises, which have been associated with the downturn of one of these long-term economic cycles. And we have seen that downturn. We know that this sixth economic cycle is struggling. That's why we've seen the things we've seen to try to hold it together. And last year in December, or late November actually, we first got the weekly reading of the M2 going below the zero line, and it remains there today. So that gives us evidence of the environment we're in. While we saw this sixth economic cycle, try to peak in conjunction with the 2020 top, COVID was, it was also an opportunity to reinflate. This was done through increased government spending in the form of debt creation. The supply chain shortages that followed, that was an opportunity to reinflate with higher commodity prices. And then that in turn was an excuse to, or an avenue, however you want to say it, a tool, but an opportunity to push rates higher. All of which has been, a tool to fight these inflationary forces that have been trying to take hold and started trying to take hold in really in 18 and into 19, just before the COVID top, and then again the deflationary forces that the money masters have been trying to fight since 2002. We started seeing that again at that top, but then what I'm saying is that COVID was an opportunity to step in with the supply chain shortages and raising of interest rates and to prevent that deflationary force from taking hold. And, I've explained this all in great detail in a series of the, you asked about the research letter, but in a series of these letters, it's deep, but I've explained this in great detail there. But, in essence, that's where we're at. We're sitting at the top of this sixth economic cycle that's trying to roll. And, but we have to have structure. And again, this sixth economic cycle to back up and kind of recap on it. It began out of the 2002 low with the monetary policies that we started seeing coming out of that low. And if you just think about it with common sense, that, what have they been fighting? Why have we seen the efforts with, QE and all, coming out of the 2002 low is when the Fed really started doing their thing with their heavy hand and trying to prevent the downturn. And remember the term bridge the gap and all this sort of stuff. And it's because they saw this sixth economic cycle or the economy trying to roll. But all of these things that they have done, it has fueled this sixth economic cycle and created, as a byproduct, while it's held it together on one hand, is it's created the biggest bubble in history. And it's biggest bubble in history is associated with this fabricated sixth economic cycle. So we're left with this it's like a, I don't know what to call it, a time bomb, a financial time bomb that they're continuously trying to hold together. And again, like I said, we saw it try to crack in 07. Saw it trying to start to crack. I was seeing signs of it in 18, 19, and then it kind of cracked in 2020. COVID was an opportunity to pull it back together. Now here we sit again, pushing into another four-year cycle top, which will be the next opportunity, if that makes sense.
Now, Tim, you like to track money supply, the velocity of money, using data. Do you feel that the inflationary phase that we're in right now is due to a money oversupply, which means high interest rates would be the cure? Or is this a supply chain problem where it doesn't matter how high the interest rates go, you're not going to get all the goods flowing until there's a concrete effort to make sure that these supply chain problems are solved?
Look, this inflationary bout has been, and I've proven this in letters based on hard data, research, and charts, and correlations, and I mean tangible evidence. This entire rate hiking, my mind digressed to the interest rate thing. This entire commodity upswing out of the 2020 low has been on the back. Now, there were some natural cycle lows there. There was a three-year cycle low in the cyclical world due at the 2020 low, and it came in on track. But again, it was fueled by these supply chain shortages, and I have proven with charts and data that this entire inflationary bout, if you will, has not been monetary. And let me explain that. We saw the largest percentage advancing, single percentage advancing 3-year cycle out of the 2020 3-year cycle low in the commodity complex since the inception of the CRB data. The single highest percentage advancing 3-year cycle. And you look at that, and I'm not saying it's not inflationary. It was inflationary as hell. I go to the grocery store just like everybody else. You bet it was. I'm not at all saying that. But what I'm saying is there is an inverse relationship between the dollar. It's a matter of fact. I mean, you can overlay the charts and look at it. But there's an inverse relationship between the dollar and commodity prices, and historically they move inversely. There's an inverse relationship, and now sometimes when the cycles are trying to transition, there's not a big move, they're kind of muddied, and there's not much activity, but when you stand back and look at it, it's an inverse relationship. Coming out of that low, that 2020 low, we also saw the longest advancing, it's a cycle of about a year in duration in the dollar, but it stretched beyond belief. It stretched to nearly twice its duration. So we saw this enormously extended cycle coming out of a low in the dollar, a four-year cycle low in the dollar, in conjunction with the advance in commodities. So that proves that it wasn't monetary, that it was largely supply chain driven. So yes, I think answering your question, this was supply chain driven, and I'm not sure that it's over because, you know, there was commodities have been trying to peak. I was looking for a 3-year cycle low in commodities, and I wrote in a December letter that it was due sometime between April and September of this year, and we saw that low in May. So we're seeing an upswing in commodities. I think it's probably counter trend and will set us be part of the setup with this long-term 6 economic cycle.
Does this mean if it's a supply chain problem that higher interest rates are not the cure and in fact would be contributing to it because companies can't afford to borrow the money to solve the problem?
Bingo. That's what I've been saying all along, and I've proven that. Exactly. I mean, how do raising rates fix a supply chain problem? They don't. And so that's another piece of this holding this 6 economic cycle together. I have something I call my checkmate chart. And so subscribers see this, it's complicated and deep. It's deep analysis, and oftentimes things that are counterintuitive. But when you look at the data, you go, aha, I see it. But part of holding things together is they needed rates to go up, commodities to go up, and equities to go up. And this entire upswing out of the 2020 low and the rate hiking cycle, that has also been largely created, if you will, with, they put a low in interest rates using the reverse repos to push rates higher. And then they started talking about raising rates, and people may not remember this. I remember because I was watching it real time, but the Fed started saying, you know, that they were going to raise rates to fight inflation, the supply chain induced inflation, which, like you said, had no effect on it, but they needed to get rates up. And so they used the reverse repos to do that, and then they talked rates up, and then they started raising rates. And so we've seen this enormous rate hike on the heels of this, the environment we're in, which is detrimental, but in the short term, it keeps that checkmate chart from coming to pass, and therefore it keeps the deflationary spiral at bay. And you just have to see that data to make sense. But it's an absolute truth.
If the bubble should prove to peak with your sixth economic cycle, what does that mean?
Massive deflation. It means that potentially, I hate to say this, but you ask, I'll tell you, it's potentially the end of the system as we know it, which is why I think they've been, you know, it's been such a battle to try to hold things together. I think that's why we saw the things we saw coming out of the 2002 low. It's why we saw the QE and the spending that we saw coming out of the 2009 low. It's why we saw the spending and the things that we've seen coming out of the 2020 low. It's the basis for the monetary policy that we've seen. And I got some numbers right here that I had written down. Let me share this with you. When I say spending, everybody says that, you know, they're printing money. They're not printing money, they're printing debt. Let me give you some examples. And again, you mentioned names, and then people think you're taking sides. I'm not taking sides, I'm just stating the facts. I could give less than a shit about politics, just to be perfectly honest. I don't have a side. I don't care, I'm neutral. But, coming out of the 07 low, Obama, took office, of course, right after that crisis, and his spending, I just averaged the numbers, his spending was $272 billion per quarter, and that's the rate at which the federal debt stacked up. Trump's spending, and under his administration, the debt accumulated at a rate of $517 billion per quarter. It nearly double the rate of Obama's. Biden's is just under, and the last numbers I have here where I looked at it is just under, it's $415 billion per quarter. So it's just under what Trump's were. But my point is that coming out of each financial crisis, when you look at it, and even going back, if you go back further and look at the 2020, you know, the 02 low, coming out of each of these financial crises, what we've seen is this government spending, this debt escalation, if you will, to try to hold this thing together. It's all part of the monetary policy to try to hold it together. And, they've done a wonderful job at that. And I understand why, because, like I said, it's potentially the end of the system when this thing goes, and that's a bold statement to make, but I think that explains why we've seen what we've seen. But then they point to the stock market and say, hey, everything's great, but in reality, it's all been on the back of monetary policy. It's not economic. It's been on the back of monetary policy and government spending, and regardless of who's in office, whenever the next financial crisis comes, Democrat or Republican. Again, I'm not picking sides. I don't care. I think we're going to see an escalation above even the figures of the Trump administration and the Biden administration. Or if it occurs under Biden's administration, it's going to eclipse the Trump administration. But the point is that it has escalated exponentially under each administration following each crisis. And I did some projections, and I think with the next, based on these increases, based on the next crisis, again, regardless of who's in office, I think we're going to see the federal debt go to somewhere between $45 and $60 trillion.
Do you have any economic indicators that suggest this market could be nearing a top or that the economy is turning around?
Yeah, not that it's turning around, but I covered something a few newsletters ago that I found, research letters ago that I found, and in the beginning about the letter, and this is an example. I'll give you two examples. A data mine data and then tie it to cycles. And what does it mean? And one such data mine, an example an indicator of where we are, unemployment growth rate. What I found is that every time the unemployment growth rate rises above its zero line, in other words, unemployment rate, it's escalating, the slope of the curve is going up, and it moves above its zero growth rate line. Going back into the 1940s, every time that has occurred, it's been associated with a recession. Now, what's the timeline for that, or time lag for that recession? Sometimes it may lead a little bit, sometimes it may lag a little bit, but 100% of the time, no exceptions, going back into the 40s, it's been associated with a recession. Well, we crossed that line a month or so ago. So looking at that, it tells you the environment we're in, and it tells you that it should be baked in the cake. It's a matter of like I said in the beginning, it's a matter of the proper setup and structure to cap the equity market, to peak interest rates and commodities for that matter, and then the setting up of the so-called checkmate chart. I'll give you another example of that. Federal tax receipts. I found, going back again into the 40s, data mining that all but four recessions, going back into the 40s, have been accompanied by a downturn of federal tax receipts below their zero growth rate line. In other words, tax receipts are declining. And that's, associated, I mean, the way I see that, income is down, so tax receipts are down. So it's an indication, it's a leading indicator of something to come, and we've crossed that line. Another statistic with that is 100% of the time that, going back again into the 40s, that's pretty strong statistics. 100% of the time that's occurred, it's been associated with a four-year top in equities. And it's that four-year top that we're looking for here to give us the stepping stone and the opportunity, if you will, to for the downturn out of the sixth economic cycle. So all this stuff ties together and it explains the environment that we're in, but we got to have all the stars aligned just right. We got to see this proper cyclical structure. We got to see all these things fall into place before it can happen. But what this tells us is it paints a clear picture of the environment we're in and, the danger that we face, but we have to see the proper setup to cap it. And again, you ask about the letter. That's the sort of thing I cover. And right now the focus is on getting that proper setup. And I don't know if it's going to come next week, next month, or 6 months from now, or 2 years from now. I'll see it when I see it. It is what it is, as they say. But I have to see the proper things fall in place.
So when do you see all of this coming to a conclusion?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. When, Jim, when it sets up properly, you can see, you can have, let me give you an example. Well, I'll use the example I used a while ago. In 2007, at the peak, I think it was in August, it may have been July, I had absolutely, there were some missing components to conclude the setup with that top. And so I knew statistically speaking, looking at all this data, that you know, we didn't have all the pieces parts in place, and so we shouldn't have had the top. And I got numerous phone calls from people thinking, because it was so stretched, and had been talking about a top, and people call, is this a top? Is this a top? I said, no, we need another push up because we're missing some things. And we got that push up into October, bada bing, bada boom, everything fell in place quickly, and it fell on its own weight. You know, the trap door opened. The same sort of thing happened in 2020. You know, I was looking for a top. We pushed into a top in January, but we were missing some things. We got a little decline into late January, early February. We pushed up into mid February. It all fell in place, bada bing, bada boom, and it just happened. And then sometimes you get in a period like coming out of the 02 low, where it just stretches and stretches and stretches and stretches. And that was the longest four-year cycle advance in history. And every time it would try to set up, it wouldn't set up. It would morph into it just wouldn't bite. All the pieces, parts would not fall in place. And we ended up with the longest extended cycle, four-year cycle in the history of the Dow Jones Industrials, going back to 1896. But ultimately, it did set up at the 07 top. So I said all that to say this: we have to see the proper setup with the DNA markers. And I don't know when that's going to happen. It's going to happen when it happens, and understanding what you're seeing with the structure and those markers, I think, is what's key. And that's the guidance. So whenever that happens, I don't know. I suspect, let me try to give you a better answer. I suspect that once this four-year cycle top is confirmed in equities, that knowing that the environment that we're in, that it's going to put us at great risk. And the question is going to be, can they pull another rabbit out of the hat to try to save it by reinflating in some way? And, you know, that seems like a stretch at this point, knowing the environment we're in. But, you know, who knows? But the answer to the question is, this next four-year cycle top will be the opportunity for this unraveling and the sixth economic cycle to peak.
What do you see ahead for interest rates?
Well, that's a deep subject. This interest rate, we touched on this a little bit earlier. This interest rate hiking cycle should have never began. And again, that's deep, deep, that's a deep subject. But I have, you know, matrix that show that, going back, you know, looking at interest rates back into the 40s and beyond. And but it did. You know, it was because of the supply chain induced inflation, they were able to, like I said, in the use of reverse repos, putting a floor under rates back in March, April, May of 21. Right as rates were moving below zero. I mean, the short-term rates had declined right back to the level, to the 2020 low. And that's when the reverse repo operations and stuff began. They launched this rate hiking cycle that, you know, based on all historical precedents, should have never began. But now here we sit. And that said, we're at a point where, looking at the matrices that I have looking for tops, you know, hard data that shows and identifies rate hiking cycle tops, this cycle should have peaked. When I say cycle, this rate hiking cycle should have peaked two rate hikes ago. So we're in uncharted water there. And I think, again, the reason for that is trying to keep rates high, commodities up, equities up. But at the same time, like we talked about, this rate hiking cycle is also detrimental. But to raise was the lesser of the two evils at the time. And so now I think the box is getting tighter, but here we are, you know, regardless. And looking at where we're at this time, I know there's a Fed meeting coming up. Based on short-term rates and what I see now, it's a close call. It wouldn't surprise me if they raise. It also wouldn't surprise me. It's not clear because it's razor thin what I see. It wouldn't surprise me. I tend to lean toward that they may pause here if we see short, if the short-term T-bill turns up between now and the Fed meeting, then we may get a hike out of it. But it wouldn't surprise me to see a pause here and see equities move higher. But the answer to the question, we should be close to the top of a rate hiking cycle. And by any historical precedence, it should have already been over.
What are your thoughts on gold and commodities?
Well, we also touched on this a little bit, but the three-year cycle low in the CRB, like I said, I was looking, and that's just a measure of the commodity complex, but I was looking for that low, wrote in the December letter that low was due in somewhere between April and September. We saw the low in May, so that was right, and we're seeing an upturn here. With gold, there was a nine-year cycle low, I think, we saw that low in last November, and so it's in place. But the fact that it's been so weak, I think, is telling. I think that's signaling the deflationary forces. And if we see, again, the right cogs in the wheel set up with the peaking of rates and interest rates, and commodities, and a four-year top in equities, then that's going to leave us set up with very left translated tops in commodities and part of the setup, overall setup, with a peaking of the sixth economic cycle. And I think that's what we face. And so right now, I think, like I said, the weakness in gold, the cycle is still up, but I think the weakness is signaling or sniffing or telegraphing or however you want to say it, the deflationary forces at this point. But I'm looking for once this sixth economic downturn takes hold, I think it's deflationary in commodities and gold will go with it.
Tim, anything else you'd like to tell us about today that you've been concerned about?
Nope. It's just this sixth economic cycle. I hope I painted a picture of the environment that we're in. I've covered this in a number of letters, research letters, along the way over the last, 6 or 8 months or longer, and great detail. So if anyone's interested in that research and understanding more about this, again, I hate to feel like I'm using the word too much, but this sixth economic cycle is critical. And that's where we sit. That's what I do. It's available in the letter if anyone's interested.
And again, how can people sign up for the newsletter?
Cyclesman.com.
Tim, thank you so much for chatting with us and being on This Week in Money.
Thank you.
My guest has been Tim Cyclesman Wood, editor of Cycles News and Views on Cyclesman.com. He was speaking to us from beautiful Gulf Shores, Alabama. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Danielle Park, and Tim Cyclesman Wood. If you have any questions for the show, you can send them to info@housestreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer at Recyclico. Welcome back to the show, Zarko.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Zarko, what's new at Recyclico?
Well, as I mentioned at the end of the last podcast, Recyclico is going to be an exhibitor at the Fully Charged live event here in Vancouver from this weekend, so from September 8th to 10th, and I'll be speaking on one of those panels on the Saturday during the event at around 1 p.m., and the panel is going to be called Batteries, Are They Ethical, Sustainable, and Recyclable? So it's going to be a lot of interesting questions coming from the panel questions and answers coming from the panel and the audience, but I'll be actually joined by Rebecca Paisley from WSP, Ken Hendricks from the Automotive Retailers Association, and Sandy Monroe from the Monroe and Associates, or as some of you know as well from our Monroe Live video that came out last month. So I also just want to thank everyone for who reached out for tickets. I know some will be flying in to see the event. Please stop by our booth. I really look forward to meeting everyone in person. We'll have our team there as well. So just kind of put a face to the names. Just looking forward to some great conversations. And then later this month, we'll be also traveling to Taiwan to meet with our JV partner Zenith, and have some meetings with Zenith and some other companies as well, but as well visit the site location that we are designing and building our first commercial plant on, which will be in Taiwan. And also before our visit, Zenith's technical team will also be visiting us at the demonstration plant. And they're going to be observing our ongoing testing at the demonstration plant. They're going to be looking to understand kind of the different unit operations from so they themselves can prepare their team for the commercial construction and operation in Taiwan. They're going to be looking at through the different stages of leaching and impurity removal and the precursor production and lithium hydroxide production and lithium carbonate production. So, it's going to be quite a busy week when they visit as well, and then also when we visit. But, these initial steps of the JV will be some of the most critical to ensure a successful scale-up and a positive demonstration of our advanced process and business model, really to the rest of the world. And this first success, I think, will help streamline further expansion as well. Because I think since the announcement of our commercial JV with Zenith, I've noticed personally myself that it's garnered just a lot of interest from the market. So I know we're just going to have a lot of eyes on us, and to see the success of this hydrometallurgical plant. And, maybe one more topic, I'd like to maybe discuss, given I'll be doing quite a bit of talking, this week at the Fully Charged event, but, what I'm seeing kind of in the battery industry, it's quite clear that, the battery industry itself has been a major recipient of some really big funding rounds that have been recently announced, even despite the shaky market in general. And some of these funding rounds have actually been in the battery recycling industry, just kind of gives a sense for kind of where the interest is, from others. And now I understand that, our peers in the battery recycling industry are approaching the battery waste problem in a different way. And they do this by focusing on the construction of a large facility. They'll focus on processing waste from multiple sources. But I also believe this falls prey to, I think, one of the biggest risks in the recycling industry, which is the supply of battery waste. And without battery waste feed, for this mixed batch of feed, it is going to really become difficult to manage the utilization of these large facilities. And these large facilities, keep in mind, are also going to require a lot more capital to build and operate, hence some of the very large funding rounds that have been announced. And our Recyclico's nimble approach of working more strategically with partners to build a recycling solution that actually vertically integrates materials, the battery materials, in-house, promotes more of it allows for a low capital intensity facility with, not as high of cost, but then that also has the flexibility to expand modularly as the secure source of battery waste supply continues to grow as well. So now this is going to keep, costs down, operational costs down, and it's going to provide that flexibility as well to grow with the market. So these, you know, these peer comps right now paint one kind of picture, but from Recyclical's perspective, you know, we're really going to continue working on securing additional commercial JVs around the world using our advanced and efficient technology, and really demonstrating that, you know, through the success of these JVs, how we can grow with the industry, and to be, you know, one of those companies that really comes out as a success when it comes to battery recycling industry through a really long thought out process of how we're going to approach this, on a strategic level and for the long term supply of battery waste materials. That's all I really have for you today, Jim.
Sarco, for people new to Recyclico, what does the company do and where are you traded?
Yeah, Recyclico is a battery materials company focused on the recycling and upcycling of lithium ion battery waste. We go directly from not just recycling material, but also going directly into the battery ready products, which are known as the precursor cathode active material and lithium hydroxide, where, you know, we've taken this material and have been able to, you know, sent it to different companies who have made battery cells directly out of that material and have tested it for its performance as well. And, you know, the company is publicly traded. Our shares are traded on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4. And you can get more information on our website on www.recyclical.com.
Sarco, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Sarco Masalgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on September 8th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.